Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio. Every week, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller interviews CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now, your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is Alistair Thompson, the Chief Information Officer of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute in the National Institute of Health. Alistair, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Hi, Jason. It's great to be here.
All right, let's just start with the basics. I think this is the first time I've had someone on my show from the NHLBI, which is a mouthful in and of itself. But let's just discuss the mission of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute.
The NHLBI is one of 27 institutes and centers at the National Institutes of Health. Each of those ICs, we call them, is focused on a particular area of health. We jokingly say that allergy and infectious diseases gets the interesting things like Ebola. We just get the diseases that actually kill more people than anything else, heart disease, COPD, those kinds of things. And so our mission is to provide leadership for research, training, and education that promotes the prevention and treatment of heart, lung, blood, and sleep diseases, and generally enhance the health of all individuals so they can live longer and have more fulfilling lives. And we do that through two programs. We have our extramural program, where we basically give away money as grants to researchers in research institutions across the world. And then we have our intramural program, where we have researchers on the NIH campus in Bethesda, Maryland, who are doing basic research, clinical research, all around these areas. Two very different environments for me to deal with. One is closer to academia, the other one is closer to regular government.
I want to get into how you support that mission, but the one that you and really that we're talking about today is really the internal research, the stuff that's happening on the Bethesda, Maryland campus.
Right. And as I say, that's the place which is more a little more like academia, which presents some interesting challenges. Academia is about sharing information, sharing research data. But at the same time, we have to make sure that we're protecting for IT security and things, the environment that those researchers work in can present some challenges. These people are very smart and they're pushing the envelopes. And we've got to provide an environment which is safe, but lets them communicate and collaborate the way they need to.
And I know we'll probably get to that later on about shadow IT, because that's a major problem with research institutions. I've talked to people at NASA, the NASA Space Centers, National Science Foundation, you name it. Shadow IT is a big concern for CIOs, but we'll get to that in a sec. So talk about your role as CIO. You're helping the mission area. You're helping the back office area. How do you support the NHLBI's mission?
In the extramural side, we're providing the usual kind of services any grant-making organization has, but we have a scientific flavor to it. So one of the key things for us at the moment is understanding research portfolio, where the best bang for the buck is, where are we going to get the best research for the best funds. And that's both a scientific question as well as a fiscal question. We've got to understand where the science is going, where the gaps are, see what we should fund versus others funding them, because we don't want to fund the same things others do. But on the intramural side, it's our scientific director talks about the intramural program as being a nest. It's a place where he provides an environment and the researchers can go and do whatever it is they need to do in their research. I have much the same philosophy. I need to provide them a safe, secure computing environment where they can do what they need to do and then get out of the way to a very large degree.
Now, does that make your job harder to get out of the way, per se? Because then you do end up with people bringing in applications or they bring in hardware that you're not maybe aware of, and that causes more challenges? Or as one CIO once told me, they give them a really, really wide road and you can drive anywhere on the road you want, but stay on the road. Don't go on the grass, so to speak.
We do try to provide a very wide road for them to work on. But in the end, at times, they're going to find something that they really just have to have. They're on the bleeding edge. And we have to figure out how to deal with it. We've built a really good cooperative relationship with the scientists. They know if they want to do something which is a bit unusual, they can come talk to us and we'll figure out a way to make it happen. I think one of the most interesting ones we've had recently has been around the use of cloud services for doing real-time reconstruction of MRI images to markedly shorten the time it takes to do an MRI. When they first came to us, the researcher, Dr. Michael Hansen, there was kind of this reaction of, how can you possibly do that? That's patient data. That's some of our most precious data. But the benefits to it were so great, we had to figure out a way to do it. And working with Dr. Hansen, we went through and worked out how to secure it appropriately, making sure that data is protected as it traverses, making sure the data is actually never stored in the cloud. And now that's being moving to experiments in terms of a commercial scale in the cloud, and is one of the more exciting things that we're doing, because this is something that, particularly for pediatric MRIs, where you can imagine your child being fed into a tube in a hospital, it's a bit scary. And if they have to do that for an hour versus 20 minutes, obviously it's a big benefit for the child and also for the stress level of the parents.
And I know we talked about this when I moderated a panel that you were on, I think during Health IT Day, maybe a few months ago. I thought it was a fascinating example of cloud moving into the mission and making this such a big deal. I'm excited as we go on through your priorities, how else cloud is being used throughout your efforts. Talk a little bit about your role as CIO in terms of operational versus strategic. Do you have a foot in both sides? Are you more one side operational or one more the other strategic?
So it's very much a foot in each camp. You know, we have about 1,800 staff here at NHLBI. And so I have to provide the normal computing services they have, as well as the environment for research. And it has all the usual challenges. You know, we're dealing with an explosion of data. I used to buy storage in terabytes. Now I'm buying it in petabytes. And I expect that not to change over the next several years. Finding computing resources for the researchers. How do we apply enough compute to be able to deal with that data? Again, this is part of the reason we've been looking so heavily at cloud. On the other end of it, I just have the normal operational things. You know, we have data centers, which we've consolidated into the NIH primary data centers in Bethesda and disaster recovery in Stirling, which makes things easier for us. It saves us money because someone else is actually handling all of the hosting for it, but we operate them. And so I have to deal with 24/7 operation on the science side where nothing can go down. If they've got an experiment running, then the IT has to keep running so that we can be capturing the data from that experiment.
And I'm sure that in and of itself is challenging to, you know, the 24/7, nothing can go down, the backups. Is that something that you have a specific team? So, because that moves us into the makeup of your office a little bit, feds versus contractors. How do you deal with that 24/7 operations need, but as well as kind of dealing with that, you know, 9-to-5 back office need?
My office is split into two major pieces. One is focused on operations. The other one is on new software development, which kind of fits the operational versus strategic split. The operational group, I have, you know, 8 or 9 feds, and we have about 40 contractors who support the operations. Because the things are sitting in the NIH data center, we don't necessarily have to have people on site to keep things fed and watered constantly, because the hardware is being monitored, cooling and everything else by the Center of Information Technology. We have to have people on call to deal with the applications that need to be managed and kept and maintained for the researchers.
Now, it sounds like from an operations side, it's about a 5-to-1 ratio, 8 or 9 feds, 40 contractors. Is that ratio about right, or do you want to make it a little higher, a little lower? What's your thoughts on that?
I'd like to move it more towards federal staff. One of the risks I have is that there's a lot of institutional knowledge, which is in contractors' heads. And obviously, contracts can change when they have to be recompeted every 5 years. I've increased the size of the federal team slightly, bringing in people, often veterans, who have a lot of experience with this kind of IT, to be able to give us that institutional knowledge that stays around. We work fairly closely with our human resources group to bring in people via our Pathways program, which brings in recent graduates. And we're very much about growing a federal workforce who really understands our mission, really understands what we need to do to support it, while continuing to be able to get the innovation and the things that we get from our contract partners.
You mentioned there's two sides of the operational group, and then there's also the software development. Is most of that done in-house, or is most of that done by contractors?
Most of the software development is done by contractors. We have about 180 contractors, most of whom are actually working off-site in their own environments, and we have about 15 feds who manage that particular side of the house. It's an interesting environment. We've had a philosophy of COTS first from the beginning, the view that only where there is something very specific to our mission should we be using custom software, and that 80% solutions are usually good enough. It's been a journey as we've worked through that. We've moved heavily towards using agile methods. We've been doing some interesting contracting within that, using firm fixed price contracts for agile. We've had some successes. We've had some not quite so good successes. But in each case, we've actually delivered what it is that we were supposed to deliver. And we've learned a lot about how to do agile in government, how to work with some of our contract partners who have much more experience than the government side does to actually make it work. One of the biggest challenges for us in that is with the NHLBI staff, helping them understand that, hey, we're going to show you a new version of software every 2 weeks. And it might not be fully functional, but as soon as you think it's got value, we'll deploy it. The reaction has been either been very positive or why aren't you delivering perfect software for us? And the answer, of course, is that, well, we'll deliver perfect software for you never. So let's deliver good enough.
That's fascinating. Why don't you deliver perfect software? The answer is always the same. That is a perfect world, which we know we don't have. We don't live in one. So sometimes it's hard to explain that to people who don't understand software development.
Yeah, particularly with scientists, you know, who are used to, you know, repeatability and rigor. But they're starting to understand that we can give them a lot of value very quickly if they're not looking for perfection. We often use the old adage, you know, don't let let perfection be the enemy of the good. And it's really allowed us to introduce some quite significant changes to our systems, ranging from a new intranet where we're integrating using enterprise mashups, tools from across HHS, from across government and across NIH, to workflow systems, document management, and we're in the midst of deploying an e-acquisition system at the moment for our Office of Acquisitions. There's a lot going on. Agile really helps us to keep it sort of coordinated and focused on, you know, delivering those small increments of value to our user community.
All right, on that note, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we can talk a little bit more about your workforce, discuss your background a little bit, and then we'll jump into your priorities. My guest this week is Alistair Thompson, the Chief Information Officer of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute in the National Institutes of Health. I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest today is Alistair Thompson, the Chief Information Officer for the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute in the National Institutes of Health. Now, Alistair, before break, we were talking a lot about your background, a lot about your office, your setup. You gave us some heads up on some priorities. So let's just jump right in. What are you trying to get done over the next 6 or 9 months?
There's a couple of big things we're dealing with at the moment. I mentioned earlier the massive growth in data. We've been deploying some new storage systems across, particularly for the intramural program, which is a mixture of commodity-based storage for lower performance but highly redundant storage, some high performance storage from EMC, and some extremely high performance DDN grid scalar storage to be associated with our high performance computing clusters. It's an interesting challenge. We're not just dealing with normal sort of performance needs that an organization has. They range from, I just need to store 2 or 3 petabytes of data, to I need to compute on hundreds of terabytes on a computer that has 20,000 CPUs in it. It makes for some very interesting challenges, and we're still working out exactly how to do some of that. Associated with that is our push for cloud. That amount of data, frankly, we simply can't afford to store ourselves. We don't have the space for it. And so our first forays into the cloud have been around how are we going to archive that data. And so we've been working with both Amazon and Microsoft on models for doing that. At the same time, we're increasingly seeing cloud as being just a good place to host our applications. We moved our public website to Amazon about 2 years ago. We're actually about to now move that into Microsoft's Azure because their environment for us is more compelling at the moment, which is presenting some interesting challenges in terms of portability to be able to do it. Because we developed this using good open source technologies like Drupal, moving it is actually fairly easy. You've got to think about those things before you actually start moving to the cloud. Otherwise, you're going to end up locked into particular vendors. Our next step is really looking at disaster recovery and continuity of operations. Again, we're working with Microsoft on integrating our internal systems. You could call it a private cloud, but it's not quite. But integrating our internal systems with instances that run in Azure, in the GovCloud, and then allow us to operate from either place transparently. That's a longer-term project, but we hope over the next 6 months to actually start running some applications, smaller applications, in the Microsoft cloud.
All right, there's several there I want to follow up on. Let me move back and talk about the commodity-based storage versus the extremely high-performance storage. You talked about the need to run so much data through a computer that has something like 20,000 CPUs. What's the challenge there? Is it just the scale we're talking about or the amount of data?
Primary issue is parallel access. In order to keep those CPUs fed, each of them needs to be able to interact with the storage and not do it in a serial manner. You know, a normal NAS, you don't have much option. With these high-performance GPFS file systems that we're using, they can talk to multiple of those CPUs at once. And because it's doing parallel operations for genetic sequence analysis, for instance, same operation, but on multiple places within the genome, hence multiple CPUs work well, you've got to have the storage that can handle that as well in order to get the real bang for the buck out of the cost of a high-performance computing environment.
Are you figuring out how to fix those issues, or is that something that is you have to work with vendors and others?
We work closely with vendors. We've got a really good team here who has a lot of experience with high-performance computing. Some of our environment is provided by NIH Central, but some of it we've built ourselves. We have one researcher, Dr. Brooks, who is actually literally built a high-performance computing environment himself. He and his team have worked closely with us to get what they need and get the storage they need in place to be able to make the most use of it.
There's other agencies you mentioned earlier on that you also maybe worked at Commerce with NOAA that do a lot of high-performance computing. Are you collaborating with other agencies in terms of who are facing a very similar problem and seeing how they're handling it?
There's a lot of engagement between our HPC team and those across government, across research. So yes, there's a lot of cross-fertilization. There's a lot of discussions going on at the moment at the NIH level about how to leverage other investments that the federal government has made in high-performance computing so that we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. With the implementation of Internet 2 and the high-speed 100 gigabit network that NIH has just deployed, making use of those remote resources is suddenly much more feasible, just as it's more feasible to use cloud resources for those in some cases. We've been doing experimentation in both Azure and in Amazon with spinning up clusters of many, many compute nodes and seeing how we can move data in and out of there in an effective manner. It can be challenging if you've got a constant workload that's consistently there. The cloud model is usually more expensive than building something locally. But a lot of what we do is very bursty. You need to do an analysis on a massive amount of data, so you need to spin up 40,000 nodes for a couple of days. You can then shut them down again. And so cloud looks like a very compelling environment for that. We've got several experiments going on with researchers at the moment to look at it for biophysics simulations of cell membranes and things, to the MRI thing I mentioned earlier, genomic work, as well as image processing and generation of images off some of the more advanced scientific instruments, the super resolution microscopes and electron microscopes that are coming online now.
You mentioned Internet too. I had a very interesting conversation with the NOAA CIO about a month ago, Zach Goldstein, and he mentioned the use of Internet too as well. Is that something you mentioned? NIH just launched the high-speed network. Are you guys also part of that?
Yeah, we are. So the NIH made a major investment in moving our entire backbone up to 100 gigabit and then getting 100 gigabit connectivity to Internet 2, which also then gives us 100 gigabit connectivity to Amazon plus most other research institutions around the country. It's a critical resource for us. We're following the Department of Energy's model of a science DMZ, which allows for free flow of the data using different compensating controls than firewalls so that things can move at high speed. Interesting challenges in securing it. We've been working with the NIH CIO to make that work effectively for us. We have some instruments and some compute resources in the science DMZ now, again, so we can collaborate with scientists across the country. Increasingly, science is a collaborative, it's a team sport. And so being able to move large amounts of data around between institutions is a critical part of what we do.
And just for a comparison, the old network was the 10 gigabit network?
Yeah, it was a 10 gigabit core with 1 gigabit to the desktop. We now have, let's say, 100 gigabit. We've got a couple of labs that are connected at 40, and we have some specific servers that are connected into the core at 10 for the very large data producers, just simply so they can move the massive amounts of data they have around in a reasonable manner.
And I know a lot of my audience that listens to the show are very technical, but just for those in case they're not, the difference between a 10 and 100, and don't tell me it's 10 times faster, when you have 100 gigabit connectivity, what does that mean? Like you can move data in 2 minutes instead of 2 hours or what?
What it means, you know, we data sets for us are typically in the hundreds of gigabytes to a terabyte. With a 1 gigabit connection to a 10 gig core, you could move that in a few days. With a 10-100 sort of connection, we can actually move that in a few hours. It enables science that we've never been able to do before. And that's really why the investment was made, to enable the science. We don't just do the stuff for fun. It's really about giving the researchers the tools they need to be able to innovate. And that sometimes requires innovation on IT.
Before we go to break one more time, let me just ask you about the cloud a little bit. You started early with Amazon, then now you're moving to Microsoft. Is this just the public-facing sites, or is this a major move to a new cloud? Talk a little bit about your thoughts behind the change up between going from Amazon to Microsoft.
We're moving to public site, and that's primarily driven by cost. Given the moving from more an infrastructure as a service to a platform as a service, which we can get with Microsoft, with Drupal, which we can't get with Amazon. But we're also moving some of our storage to Microsoft as well. Some of that is because of cost, but some of it is because of the integration that the Microsoft Cloud provides with our internal infrastructure. The integration is so good that we're actually moving away from our previous virtualization environment and implementing the Microsoft environment, because it gives us single pane of glass management of both the cloud and the internal environments, and allows us to transfer workloads from one to the other as we need to. That's a significant advantage in terms of the operational costs, and also just in terms of reliability. We can move a workload, if we have a problem internally, we can move it to the cloud very, very simply.
All right, I know a lot of CIOs are looking at how to move workloads to the cloud and do that type of thing. So it's good to see you guys are making some progress, and I'm sure you may get a few calls from your colleagues asking about that. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about your priorities. My guest today is Alastair Thompson, the Chief Information Officer of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute and the National Institutes of Health. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest today is Alastair Thompson, the Chief Information Officer for the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute at the National Institutes of Health. Now, Alastair, before break, we were talking a lot about your priorities, cloud, big data. One thing you kind of mentioned, but not really, is cybersecurity. Obviously, it's on top of mind for probably every CIO. Talk a little bit about cybersecurity. You mentioned the science DMZ. I think that's an interesting concept when you talk about sharing data. But talk cyber more broadly as well.
When I arrived 2.5 years ago, I recognized we had a way to go with cybersecurity here at the Institute. I'm very fortunate that I have an executive management who gets that cyber is very important. And so we've been able to make some fairly significant investments in a variety of tools and staffing to be able to support. So when the cybersecurity sprint landed on us, we were actually fairly well prepared for it. We had to accelerate some of the things that we were doing, but it was all things that we were already head in train. That really gets to the way you've got to think about cyber. You've got to be thinking ahead at what's next. Otherwise, you're going to get caught up in it in some incident that occurs. You're never going to be able to protect yourself fully, but you've got to try and stay ahead of it. It's actually part of the reason, this may sound ironic, but it's part of the reason we're pushing to the cloud. When you actually look at the cloud environments and the resources that Microsoft and Google and Apple and all of the others put into cybersecurity in their environments, there's just no way I could spend that much money. It's just impossible. And so our realization has come to the fact that in terms of things like continuous monitoring, they can do far more than we possibly can. It changes the way you have to think about things, because the assets you need to protect are now a little different. The modes of penetration are a little different. But overall, we actually see it as improving our cybersecurity posture rather than really challenging it. You know, we've had some initial work working through FedRAMP, which has been a little challenging because there's relatively little experience with it. But in the end, we've got to an environment, I think, that is going to serve us pretty well in the future and be able to keep things secure. That said, there are some things that I'm more willing to keep here than in the cloud. Our critical patient data, for instance, where it's going to be used for treatment decisions or diagnostic decisions, that's always going to be stored on site in some of our most secure resources. It's a matter of tailoring what you're doing to the kind of data and the kind of use that you're dealing with.
And a big part of that as well is how you're writing those contracts. I know we'll get into agile and contract writing in a second, but are you beyond the typical, you must meet FSMA guidelines, must meet, you know, FSMA moderate, FSMA low, or FSMA high, whatever you're writing, are you also adding other kind of service level agreements around cyber? Is there kind of a comfortability that you have knowing the investments that these companies are making?
So we do write service level agreements into our contracts. We awarded a new one about a year ago for our operations contract. There are very hard SLAs in there for patching vulnerabilities, for instance. They have to be patched. Criticals have to be patched within 7 days. Mediums and highs have to be patched within 30 days. Lows can take a little bit longer. But they're actually measured, and as I say, although contracts tend to be firm fixed price, what they get paid is based on meeting those SLAs. It's working for us very well. And our vulnerability, after doing vulnerabilities, went way down. And the contractor is working hard to innovate ways to maintain that so that they continue to get the performance incentives and the other things that are in the contract.
Generally speaking, and I know this gets into a little bit of sensitivities, is the contractor doing well with those SLAs, meaning patching in 7 days, patching in 30 days? Because one of the big challenges I've heard from CIOs is, yeah, you can do your best to stop someone from getting in, but once they get in, if they can hop network to network to network, then it doesn't matter how well your outside defense is when your inside defense is so weak. Is this something that you're paying close attention to regarding the internal networks as much as the external networks?
Very much so. You know, we really decided 2 years ago that let's just assume they're in here and do everything we can to stop it spreading. Some of that is aggressive vulnerability management. And I know some of my colleagues, we irritate them when we have to patch in the middle of the afternoon, but we patch in the middle of the afternoon to make sure we get the maximum penetration of the vulnerabilities. It's also why we've invested in continuous monitoring. We have to see what's going on to know what the people we assume are here are doing. We certainly protect things externally. We don't want to see the vectors available for them. But, you know, the fact is the most common way of getting in is via social engineering attacks, which are much harder to protect against unless you're making sure you're patching vulnerabilities on individual workstations.
You talked about contracting quite a bit, these SLAs with the cloud contractors. You also mentioned the contracting model for Agile. Now, Agile is, again, another hot topic across government. Talk a little bit about the success you're having and how does the contracting model, the firm fixed price model, fit into that success?
Most people, when you say we're doing agile with firm fixed price contracts, their heads explode because how can you possibly get flexibility with it? We've been through a couple of iterations of the way we structured them. We've been learning from it. We've got some very good contract partners who have helped us learn. But basically, the principle that we use is buy products, not services. So buy a delivered product from them. So in the case of Intranet, for instance, we specify a product vision in the contract. We specify we want, you know, 2-week sprints, that we want you to use Scrum. We specify that you're going to do a release every 3 months or thereabouts. And then we let them tell us how they're going to do that. One of the big shifts we made is we stopped the whole let's try and guess what the government is going to spend game, and we actually tell them what the budget is. When they make their proposal, we're talking about scope and what they can get done rather than about dollars, which is a much, much more effective conversation. And what we've found is having those conversations pre-award helps us make sure that what we get, we actually get, and we actually get it on the time frame that we want it. We've actually moved to a model now where the contractors are paid by story point delivered. This was actually an innovation that came from one of our contract partners as we looked at how we fairly share risk between the government and the contractor. Some of our early ones, it was too much in our favor and pushed everything on to them. This is more balanced. Everyone makes mistakes on either end of a contract. This is a way to limit their risk exposure and make sure they get paid regularly by actually delivering functionality that the user community needs as represented by story points.
I want to understand something for a second. When you talk about, you tell them the budget up front, so you talk more about scope than dollars. So it sounds to me like when you say this project we have $1 million for and that's it. So the budget's $1 million. Tell me what you can do for that $1 million. That's the conversation versus we want to do X. How much is it going to cost? And if the contractor comes back and says that's going to cost $2 million or $3 million or $5 million, and you go, oh, that our budget's only $1 million, that stops us from the conversation. Is that the difference, that the way I described it simply?
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, the tendency is in government is to, well, it's not quite enough, let's award it anyway and see how far we get. Whereas when we go into awarding a contract, we've agreed on what the scope is they're going to deliver, and they have to deliver that scope as represented by the number of story points they're going to deliver and the product vision. And if they come back to us and say, as one of them in a recent competition did, they said, there's no way you can get this functionality for that price, we were able to go, okay, so let's talk about what is our highest priority functionality and see what we can get for that. Does that have value? Yes, it did. And so we effectively agreed on what the scope was going to be at the beginning. You know, as I say, I spent a lot of time as a consultant, as a contractor, and the frustration of trying to figure out how deeply you need to discount things in order to win is just it's not valuable to either the contracting company or the government to have the conversations like that. It's far better to talk about here's what we can deliver and then commit to delivering it.
And in many ways, it's the scope goes off track, then the budget goes off track, and then the performance goes off track. They're all related. If you can control the budget and control the scope, then performance is really the main thing you got to worry about. And that's maybe easier, generally speaking, to keep one thing on track versus trying to keep three things on track. Is that part of the benefits you're seeing?
Yeah, it is. What it does is it forces us, the government, to manage scope. Our primary job is to manage scope. We find two things with our contractors. One is if we say, hey, we'd like to do this, they come back to us very quickly and go, well, that's going to cost you this many story points. Are you sure you want to do it? That's a really good conversation to have because you go, well, okay, that's going to cost me. Do I really want it? But the other part of it is it actually encourages innovation by the contractors. One of our contract partners came to us one day on one of the contracts and said, hey, would you mind if we bought this automated testing tool? It's very new, but we think it can improve things. And it's kind of a, sure, you know, knock yourselves out. Go do that. For them, it made things more efficient. They were able to get through test cycles with using less resources. That goes directly to their bottom line. I don't mind how they do it because they're delivering the functionality I need. I'm not going to tell them precisely how they should do it. And we've seen this again and again on these fixed price contracts. There's a real incentive for the contracting companies to come and bring their ideas and to innovate.
Alistair, we're almost out of time. Before I let you go, I definitely want to talk one other topic here, health disparities and how IT is playing a bigger role to reach underserved communities. I know that's something you're very much interested in. Talk a little bit about that issue and your role.
This is really a direction that was emphasized by our new director when he came in 2 years ago, recognizing that there are distinct health disparities, geographic, societal, economic, ethnic, and that some of the diseases that we have to deal with disproportionately affect particular groups. For example, sickle cell disease, which primarily affects African Americans. And the outcomes for them in poorer communities are not as good as they are for wealthier communities. So how do we actually reach them with the information that we need to do? That seems like a simple sort of education question. But it comes down to an IT question too. So our website has been a fairly typical website, works great on a computer. It doesn't work quite so well on a mobile device. But then we realized that, well, okay, a lot of those people in those underserved communities, they don't have home computers. They don't have good internet connections. But heck, many of them have got smartphones. And so, you know, we're working very hard to make our website very accessible, especially some of the information related to sickle cell and other diseases, very accessible on a mobile device. Enable them to find out about clinical trials we're running or we're funding with other research institutions. Making sure that our website is available in multiple languages so that people have it in their first language. So something which seems like a society issue, it's a funding issue, has very real implications for how we do IT. And again, I think it's one of the reasons that I really love working at NHLBI because you see that very direct relationship between, you know, a goal we have to treat Americans in underserved communities better, that we have a very direct influence on through applying novel and interesting IT solutions.
Well, fascinating work. Unfortunately, now we are out of time. My guest today was Alistair Thompson, the Chief Information Officer for the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute in the National Institutes of Health. Alistair, thank you so much for taking the time to join me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller.